A recent legal case in Cass County is raising questions about HIV disclosure laws in Michigan. Let's turn now to Trevor Hoppe. He's a sociologist of sexuality, HIV, and the law at the University at Albany, SUNY. His research studies are titled Punishing Disease, and he's co-editor of The War on Sex. Good to have you with us, Trevor.
Thank you, Cynthia.
You wrote a piece in the Huffington Post about a man in Cassopolis. His name is Corey Rangel. Police pulled him over for a loud muffler, and it ends with the cops going through his phone and calling his sexual partners. What happened in this case?
That's right. So it all began when Corey, who was on probation for a drug-related offense, was pulled over for having a loud muffler. He was cited for not wearing corrective lenses and for driving without proof of insurance. He had to report that to his probation officer, which he did. And his probation officer originally said, basically, not a big deal. You've been great in the drug court program. You're a model sort of participant. We don't want this to interrupt your progress. But then several hours later, he got a call changing that and saying that he needed to report it to jail immediately and that he needed to bring his phone with him when he reported to jail. He did that and turned over his phone, and they demanded also that he turn over the password to get into his phone. And he didn't understand exactly what was going on, but he did not feel that he had anything to hide from the police, and so he gave them that information. And subsequently found out through people who had received calls that the police had been making calls to people in his contact and asking them if they had had intimate contact with Corey and whether they were aware of his HIV status.
Let me ask you here, this, Trevor. How did the police know about Corey Rangel's HIV status in the first place? How did that even become a part of the equation?
That's a very good question, and one that, to my knowledge, Corey or his defense team does not know yet, because the court has so far been unwilling or unable to turn over the records that would explain why he was expelled from the drug court program and why now he's at risk of going to prison.
Okay, yeah, take us to that, to the fear, the concerns. I want to, because so he's been expelled from drug court?
That's right. He was expelled from drug court after being taken into custody. And now the fear is that the judge is able now to sentence him to the full length that he would have been sentenced to for his original drug-related charges, which were deferred when he went into the drug court program. So now the judge could effectively sentence him to many years in prison. And it seems like the only thing guiding their investigation here is Corey's HIV status.
Now, isn't it the law, I want to make sure we're all clear, for HIV-positive people in Michigan to disclose their status to their sexual partners?
That's right. So in 1989, Michigan passed a law that made it a felony for HIV-positive people to engage in a sexual penetration without disclosing their status to their partner. And no charges have been filed against Corey, and the police have come out and said yesterday that there is no evidence that any criminal wrongdoing under that law occurred. What's at stake in Corey's case is just the notion that they investigated him for criminal wrongdoing when the only impetus for doing so was his HIV-positive status. So they're treating him differently than they would have an HIV-negative person on probation.
Now, we don't know all the facts of this case, and as you say, he was on probation for a drug charge. Could there be something that we don't know here that could be impelling all of this, that could be driving this?
Corey says, of course, that he has been forthcoming about the information they might have. Now, he's entitled to an open and fair hearing, and I think it's important that he get that hearing. And so part of that will be, you know, the drug court explaining their rationale.
Now, Trevor, the HIV disclosure law in Michigan were designed to protect people from getting HIV, but your research that you've done in this implies these laws are actually, what, doing what in Michigan?
Well, these laws, unfortunately, reinforce the idea that we can protect people from disease using the criminal law, which is just an accurate perception. These laws don't impact people's disclosure practices. But moreover, they target HIV singularly. We don't have these laws for other communicable diseases. And I think that exposes the fact that really what's underlying here is that we have a disease that's especially stigmatized because of the populations that it affects. So we have a law on the books not because we're really trying to promote public health, but legislators were in fact codifying stigma and morality into the law. Because if we really were trying to protect people from communicable disease, it would not be HIV being singled out in these cases. We would have a different kind of law. And I think even that would be inappropriate merely because punishment is not the best approach to controlling disease. That's why we have public health and medical institutions. Those are the institutions we have in our society to respond to and to manage epidemics and communicable diseases.
Are there other cases that you've studied, Trevor, that support your claim that really Michigan's HIV disclosure laws are inadequate or are wrong-minded?
Well, I've looked at these cases across the United States, and I guess if you wanted to argue that these laws were protecting people, you would expect to find many cases that resemble the kind of boogeyman that many people talk about of the intentional infector, the person out there who's seeking revenge or trying to infect many people. And you just don't see that to be true. The case law instead is full of people who either used protection and protected their partner from infection or had an undetectable viral load and could not actually transmit the disease to their partner, or were in a relationship and just didn't know, you know, how. They were scared. They didn't know how to disclose their status to their partners. That's the typical defendant in these cases, not the kind of malicious infector that people have in mind. And so I think it's important for people to understand that if you want to go after the boogeyman, these laws are not the way to do that. We can do that through other kinds of laws that are already on the books, assault laws, for example. General statute laws could handle cases where if someone was really out there trying to spread HIV, we could punish them using different kinds of laws. We don't need these laws to accomplish that.
And is this happening in some Michigan counties more than others?
That's a great question. It's pretty spread throughout the state. There have been cases popping up over the years since 1992 when the first case was convicted in Lake County, actually, which is a pretty remote sort of central Michigan county. And so it started there and has spread around the state. So it's interesting. You might expect the cases to be concentrated where there's more HIV, but in fact, it's quite spread throughout the state when you look at the convictions.
And I'm interested in your studies how Michigan compares with other states. Are there states you think have done a good job of using the law to protect people and prevent HIV transmission?
Michigan is quite typical in the sense that its law does not require that you show risk of transmission or that you show even that transmission occurred. So in my study, I found that less than 5% of cases in Michigan actually involved transmission of the disease. That's a quite rare outcome in Michigan. And I think that's quite consistent with other states around the country. If you wanted to look at a state where they were doing something different, where they were standing out and doing a better job, you would probably look at California, which passed their law much later in the mid-1990s. And the law there requires that you show that there was a risk of transmission, because it doesn't make sense to punish people who have put no one in harm's way. And I think California's law tried to accomplish that by also requiring that you be able to show that there was intent to harm someone. And so California has had, to my knowledge, you could count on one hand the number of felony cases in California brought under that statute, which I think reflects the real rarity of cases that are truly deserving of punishment in the way we think of these cases as playing out.
All right, and so just to kind of take us back to where we began, back to Corey Rangel's case, where do things stand and what are you watching for going forward?
I think Corey's defense now is preparing to respond based on the evidence that they're given, the court file that they're given, and I think that will be the next step, is responding to these claims that so far have not been backed up by any kind of evidence that Corey is, you know, quote-unquote deceitful, as they said in their hearing. The only thing, to my knowledge, that they could have been referring to is their presumption, again, that he was not disclosing his HIV status, which there's no evidence of, and the police yesterday reported, confirmed that fact, that there's no evidence of wrongdoing. So I think that will be the next step in terms of moving his case forward and getting him back into drug court. That's the goal here. That's where he should be. He should not be facing years in prison simply because he's HIV positive.
Trevor Hoppe is a sociologist who specializes in sexuality, HIV, and the law. Trevor, thanks so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia.